once more under the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English stead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode, or at least the second hour of an exciting episode, of The Personal Wealth Coach on this Saturday, March 5th, starring Jeff and Jake McClure. Hey, we got that right.
We did.
We have learned how to say our names in unison.
Sometimes.
Yes. Well, you're in unison.
I'm one of your sons, yes.
Right, that's it, exactly. Well, as we said, stocks did relatively well for the week. The S&P 500 up 2.67% or 2.67%, which is good. Still down for the year, for the year to date, still down for 1 year. In other words, actually, to go out and get some decent rates of return, you have to go out quite a few years. And if you have a mixture of stocks and bonds and everything else, you have to go quite a ways. We are in a slump. We're no longer in a correction. So, what do you call it when the market's down and has been down for a while, but it's not a correction?
A down market.
Oh, yeah, but it's not going down. See, a down market at least implies to me that the market is moving steadily lower. So what we have is a down market rising. That's what we call it a slump. We have a caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yeah, good morning.
Good morning.
A fixed income of $1,820 a month started back in 2008.
Mm-hmm.
In 2016, still get $1,820 a month.
Good.
How much buying power has been lost due to inflation?
In the past?
So in 8 years?
Yeah.
Well, first off, let me say that there's a lot of definitions to that.
Yeah.
Depends on what you're buying. If you're buying gasoline, you've gained buying power.
If you're buying electronics, you've gained buying power. But this is where things get a little tricky. The way inflation is calculated is in a way that is not realistic for any individual, but it's really realistic for everybody put together. So particularly people that are on fixed income, you buy different things than other people do. When was the last time you bought a new big screen TV?
I haven't.
You haven't.
Oh, well, you know, you missed out on a great deal.
So,
so the price of those have come down.
So that's the point I'm making. Fixed income people tend to have the things that they already have, and they like those things in a lot of cases, and they don't see the need or the want or the ability to get something else that's new. So a big flat-screen TV costs one-tenth of what it did just a few years ago. You don't get that savings because you didn't buy it. This is why I'm saying it's not – inflation isn't directly at you. Now, over the last 3 years, you've experienced a pretty big pinch in that food prices were up, oil and gas were up, energy costs were up. They're now way down. So when we were at the peak of that, you saw some buying power decrease when we didn't have inflation across the rest of the United States. You saw inflation, or you saw deflation. I'm sorry, you saw inflation.
Yeah.
You saw prices going up for the same price.
Now you've seen prices going down. Now, the only way that you're going to actually be able to tell that, and I know this sounds very anti-government statistic, the only way you can actually tell that is to be very carefully track what you're buying and what you're spending to buy it, and see if here we are 8 years later, and you take the same amount of money, and you can buy less stuff or more stuff.
Right. If you're buying a new car, it costs less today than it did to buy the same car in 2008, because the same car didn't have all of the cool features that are in the new car.
No, wait a minute. Buying an eight-year-old car, that's not
no, at the time.
No, you said the same car.
Right, same car. Oh, wait a minute. Buying it.
It's the biggest element, when we talk about the consumer price index, which is actually run year over year last year, almost zero. But even if we talk about the consumer price index, are you paying rent?
No.
So, see, hey, the biggest element in the consumer price index isn't there.
Rent.
Because the biggest single element in the national CPI that's reported is either the rent you're paying or the rental value of your house. So if the rental value of your house goes up, then inflation goes up even if you didn't have to pay anything more. So it's a hard, we talk about it.
You don't experience that at all.
The CPI has some validity generally. The Federal Reserve doesn't use it.
No.
They use a different number based on what people actually buy each month.
Because they can look at the data on what's being sold in the market and then put together, well, what of those things, what was the price on those things before?
Yeah, then they take consumer things. For instance, the price of steel does not affect their basket, their consumer price basket.
Caller, when was the last time you went and bought a basket of steel? Again, never.
And you probably don't go out and buy 42-gallon barrels of oil either, do you?
Right.
No,
see, you're really
you're messing up the statistics here. You're messing up the statistics.
And so the answer, but there's another answer even beyond the numbers that's very, very important to any serious economist, and that is, do you feel like it buys less now than it bought in 2008?
Yeah.
Yes, I do, because of utilities.
Okay.
All right. One of the issues there is, and your utilities, probably the biggest one. This is something I may make a lot of power companies upset right now. They offer you this really cool thing where you can lock in your price, and you can lock it in for really, really long periods of time, and they can't raise your rates during that time period. And that sounds great when energy costs are going up, but what it means is that if you bought your energy contract, if you agreed to that contract when energy prices were high, you're locked in for that whole contract period at the height. And that's not something that they tell you. They're making money right now by selling those contracts. By saying, for instance, I've just moved. You mentioned this last week. I've just moved to Salado, and in the process, I'm looking at the energy market. I'm saying, who do I want to provide energy to my house?
Trees.
And across the board, the 3-year contract is a lot more expensive than the 6-month contract. So if I lock in a price for 3 years, I'm going to pay a lot more money on that 3-year contract every month than if I lock it in for 6 months.
Because they think prices may go up.
Well, that's part of it. They think maybe prices will go up. So, and if you're afraid of that, you can pay more for this. But the reality is that they already bought the contract. And they bought the contract based on time period a long time ago. Not a long time, really. It was only like 18 months ago. But that long-term contract, they're still trying to sell energy off of it so that they can make back their money.
Where are you seeing your utility? Is it electricity that's going up for you?
Electricity, and then we have satellite service as well.
I'd almost be willing to, I don't know this, but I'd almost be willing to bet if you look over a 12-month period, right now, you spent less on electricity in the last 12 months than you did in the previous 12 months.
Unless you were locked into a contract.
Yeah. The point is, if it's cost per kilowatt hour, because we have a really mild winter this year.
That's true.
And if you have electric heat, you probably are spending less. The utilities contract, yeah, if you're local, and if you didn't notice, CenterVision got bought.
That's Salado area. You can go.
Well, not just Salado, but the Temple. That's Temple, Belton, the whole area.
Right.
Is that local. Is that who you have on your?
No, he's DirecTV.
Okay. Well, you're seeing those go up, and that if that's the biggest thing, I would almost be. My guess is that if you went over everything, you would find that from 2008 to the present, it's been pretty flat.
And there's another piece here that's not really great about this year, but when we see exactly what we're seeing right now in the cable pricing happen in other industries, it is kind of the death knell of the industry. What we're seeing right now is cable companies are raising their rates for you to watch at the same time that DirecTV is raising their rates for you to watch. The reason why they're raising their rates isn't because it costs them any more to do what they're doing. It's because more of their customers are leaving because they're watching through broadband, through internet connections. And as more of their customers leave, their budgets don't go down with the number of customers. They still have just as much cable out there that needs to be fixed. They still have just as many employees. So they raise the rates to their existing customers. Those existing customers go, man, these rates keep going up. What's the alternative? By the way, the FCC last week just passed a rule that says that they can unpackage all of those channels so that you can choose just the channels you want.
Well, it's about time.
Yeah, that's been a long time coming. How soon that gets offered to you, I wouldn't even expect it to be offered anytime soon by a cable company, but you're going to get an offer from AT&T and from Netflix and from a lot of other places because Netflix is already using that with those add-on subscriptions. Amazon's going to be using it with add-on subscriptions. All of that stuff is saying that the very nature of the industry is about to end. DirecTV may still have customers way out there. They're probably going to go out of business and be purchased by someone else. I'm not saying this is as a for yeah. sure thing, but this is the symptom of an industry dying when they're raising costs to a smaller and smaller customer base. That happened with the big retail shops that sell electronics. What we've seen with the big, I mean, Best Buy is not doing so well. The other companies that have been in the business, they basically are selling computers. People are buying the computers so that they can buy computers online. They're selling their own destruction. And unless they find another thing to do, what they're really going to be is a showroom for Amazon. And that's what they're fighting.
And okay. One of the things you might want to do, unless you're locked into a long-term contract there, you might want to just start looking around. If that's where your big hit is, you might want to start looking around.
There's some really good rates out there now.
Across the board, if you were, and you're not, but if you were the average American, you would have seen your overall buying power of that money since 2008 be pretty close to flat. And some things would have gone up and some things would have gone down. You know, like gasoline obviously is a lot cheaper now than it was. And if you were a person who was working and you were commuting long distances each day, you would find your cost of living going down. The other thing, a lot depends on where you live and what you eat. For example, if your food, very frankly, food prices locally are higher than they are in the big cities.
Yeah,
very much so. And the big cities, the competition has forced the food prices down. Well, it hasn't forced the food prices down locally.
It's another weird reversal. It used to be you would go to the big city and the prices for groceries were more expensive because you had to bring it into the city from the country. And the country people had butchers and produce that was much less expensive because they were right next to the people that grew it. That's not the way it works anymore.
And it's funny, in Austin you can go to a farmer's market, but in Temple, which is closer to the farmers, it's really hard to find a farmer's market.
Right.
So it's just there's a lot of you can tell we're geeks, can't you? We sit and dig through this data day in and day out looking for something that is significant, and in the process we just see all kinds of other that's interesting,
that's really weird, what's going on there, that's
totally,
a reversal,
totally insignificant in the economy, but it's really interesting, you know.
Well, thank you very much, gentlemen.
Okay,
appreciate the call.
Have a good day.
You too.
Well, we did see there's a lot of things going on in the big wide world that I think we're unaware of right now because, and I don't know if you noticed this, but the news media only has so many minutes or hours or whatever to catch your attention to sell advertising.
Right.
And right now, an inordinate quantity of that time is devoted to either Donald Trump or the people who are trashing Donald Trump.
Right.
So we're missing a lot of stuff.
There's a lot of stuff going on in the world.
And we'll get to that in a minute. I want to get this caller. We have a caller. Call in on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yeah, every generation has their own characteristics. How do you see, based on your research, the investment characteristics of millennials?
All right.
Listen. Thank you.
That's a good one. The investment characteristics of the millennials. Let me start with savings. I talked about this last week, but it's something that has been consistent. Millennials save a lot of money, and they don't like credit card debt.
Mm-hmm.
As a whole, they're the highest saving group of people, as a percentage of their income, except for people above the age of 65, which isn't generational. That happens with age. Every generation saves more when they're above 65. Millennials grew up in the Great Recession. They came into their own in the Great Recession. They graduated from college with a lot of debt.
And no jobs.
And no jobs. And they didn't like it. So they've been living with their parents, and they've been saving a lot of money because that's the only way you can buy a house now. And they're very careful about how they spend their money. They do a lot of research before buying.
The national savings rate in the 1990s, when the boomers were booming at their boomiest.
That's a lot of booming.
Was about 2% or less. And some, and it actually hit negative levels
quite
a couple
bit
of
there.
Times.
Yeah.
When the boomers were booming, the boomiest, and they were driving, they were the driving force in the economy, and they're gradually losing that position now.
The Xers are taking over.
The savings levels were abysmally low, and the Xers have come in. Xers, by the way, don't save very much money either.
No.
But as the millennials begin to come in, one of the big factors that's going on in the American economy right now, one of the reasons we're having a slow recovery is because our savings rate nationally is up to 5.4%. And the vast majority of that, oddly enough, that's the millennials. They are saving money hand over fist. Why are they saving money hand over fist? Because they went through an event, the Great Recession, when they were scared silly, but even if they weren't directly affected by it.
They don't like to live with their parents.
They all know somebody who got slammed financially. And so they are running scared. They act an awful lot more like the people over 65 than they do like anybody else.
Right.
And as far as investing is concerned, they're a little bit slow to invest, but they are investing, and they're picking up speed nicely. The Xers, on the other hand, basically skipped it.
Yeah. Now, the millennials, again, the way they invest is also different. They're used to getting their data online. They're used to doing it through a phone or through a computer. They like to look up their medical symptoms online before going to the doctor. They like to look at what's going on in the economy before talking to an advisor. And that's if they talk to an advisor. The robo-advisors, the programs that are saying, here's kind of a model for you, are really getting a big foothold in the millennial generation. The millennials are taking these tests that say, where should I put the money? And they're getting a result, and they trust the result enough to do it. And I think it's an excellent thing, because at this age, the boomers couldn't afford advice, and the Xers couldn't afford advice. So the advice on how to invest has become cheap enough that new investors can use it without paying body parts on the black market to pay for it.
So overall, you can expect to see the millennials be good savers and good investors as they get older and their income goes up and they get some of their college debts paid off, which is going to be a good thing in one aspect. They and the Xers are going to contribute mightily to this is Jeff, this is what I believe at least, I think probably Jake is with me on this, is a secular bull market that will run about the next 14 years.
Yeah.
And I think that we will really be wind up pumping a lot of money into the stock market over the next 14 years because, very frankly, people are getting really, really tired of getting nearly 0% interest.
Yeah,
they are in a position where they don't believe the government will. A lot of particularly younger people do not believe the government will be there to provide them with Social Security. I personally think they will, as long as you're not making a tremendous amount of money.
If you're not making a lot of money and you're old enough, and that retirement age, just had this conversation.
Yeah, it's going to go up to 70.
It's going to go up to 70, and it may go up above that eventually as life expectancies continue to rise.
So they're going to start. Matter of fact, we've got clients who are millennials who save very regularly and very consistently. They've done the best job since the boomers started saving. The Xers kind of, like I said, skipped out on the deal to a large extent.
Right. Having said this, I think we all know millennials that don't fit that pattern. We know millennials that don't save, that are spending too much, that have a lot of credit card debt. But as an average, that's not the case. We also know Xers that have been saving tremendously, not the average on the case. So having, you know, there's a joke about three economists. They go deer hunting. And the first, they see this big buck comes out. And then the first economist goes, oh! And so they're all standing together. They all have their rifles. And the first economist aims and shoots. And he hits 5 feet to the left of the deer. And the second economist aims and shoots. And he hits 5 feet to the right of the deer. And the third economist goes, we got him!
I don't hear anybody laughing.
Because to economists, averages are the reality. And when you get down to the small level, an average is very inaccurate. At the broad level, if we're talking about all millennials, we've just said something that was pretty true.
Well, let me say something here before we break for – we only have a couple of commercials. We're going to break for commercials on a little different subject. Like I was saying, we're not paying a lot of attention to what's going on in the world. I don't know how many of you have really, really, really long memories, but if you have a really,
an
ancient long memory, you can remember that there was this country called Greece.
Is that somewhere in Asia?
Euthanasia.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay.
But I think that's
near Hawaii, right?
Yeah, yeah, somewhere. Anyway, yeah. Okay. Well, anyway, there's this country called Greece, which a few years ago was the market fell, and there was great angst and great worry that Greece was going to wreck the Eurozone, and if the Eurozone got wrecked, then the entire world would get wrecked. Greece is really not any better off. Their unemployment is 25%, and again...
They still owe a lot of money.
They're probably going to default on their debt again. Interesting point. When I quote unemployment in Europe, it's a little different than it is here. For example, in Spain, they have 21% unemployment.
If you go down to the younger people between 18 and 30, the unemployment is up in the 40%.
Well, here's the point. When they say unemployment, that doesn't necessarily mean that an employed person is getting paid.
Yeah.
Because we talk about underemployment here and U6 and how terrible. Every time I say, well, you know, unemployment's down to 4.9%, a lot of people say, oh, yeah, but the underemployment and the marginally and they go on. And basically that was the Clinton campaign to try to defeat George H.W. Bush, said unemployment was actually a lot worse than it is. And ironically, it's coming around again now. But this is the point. When we say somebody is unemployed in the United States, it means they're not getting paid to work.
Right. When they say it over there.
Spain.
Go ahead.
In Spain, they have about 30% of their country working for the government. And only about one-third of them are actually being paid. The other two-thirds are not being paid. And you might want to wonder, well, why would somebody who's working for the government in Spain, or for that matter in Greece or Italy, work for the government if they weren't getting paid? Well, the answer is really fascinating, because they're able to retire at 55, and if they retire, they will get paid.
Right. Because, so they're working for nothing so that they can not work for something.
Well, actually, it turns out they're getting paid in a peculiar way. You just have to bribe somebody to get anything done.
Right.
But
that's how they get their money. If you're working as a plumbing inspector, then you don't get paid by the government.
Right,
you get paid by the plumbers you're inspecting.
So the point that I wanted to make here is the official unemployment rate in the Eurozone is 10.3%. It really is probably closer to 15 by our standards.
Right.
In across Europe.
There's a headline here. Spain unemployment rate down to a 4.5-year low. Well, that sounds promising, right? Well, yeah, it's down to 20.9%.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, that's five times what we have.
Sure. Germany has a 4.3% unemployment rate, and that's good. It's a little better than ours, except, again, well, the Germans don't take bribes, so that's probably
right.
That's probably pretty accurate. Okay?
Yeah. Except that that's changing rapidly. They're not including the refugees in those numbers.
Oh, okay.
And when you add 300,000 people a year that are of employable age to a population, but you don't let it affect your unemployment statistic, it's because they're not being hired, and they can't be hired because they don't speak the language, so they're not putting them on unemployment. They're putting them on a different system until they get trained up so that they can get employed. So the unemployment rate in Germany is higher than that.
So what I want to say is that Europe is on the verge, and maybe is in a recession. They have negative interest rates across most of Europe right now, certainly across the Eurozone. Negative interest rates are indicative of the fact that they are teetering on the edge of a recession. This month, the European Central Bank, the market is up in Europe because the European Central Bank is expected, and they've been putting out rumors from the bank, so it's almost certainly going to happen. They're expected to start a new round of quantitative easing and buy a lot more than the $62 billion a month in bonds they're buying right now, which is flooding money into the Eurozone, trying to get deflation turned into inflation. Flip over on the other side. And I want to put this in perspective and say, remember a few years ago when there were rumors, particularly on talk radio and talk television, the talking head television, that the dollar was going to be replaced as the world currency by the euro, the world reserve currency. Nobody is even vaguely considering that at this point. Flip over to Japan. Matter of fact, if Britain leaves the European Union, the question is whether the euro can survive it. And Britain very well may leave the European Union. Right now, the polls in Britain, it's right at a 50-50. As to whether or not, if the vote were held today, it would be too close to call,
right,
on whether Britain will leave the European Union. Will that be good for anybody, for Britain or for the European Union or anybody else? No.
No.
And by the way,
no.
Expect if Britain does, if the referendum in Great Britain says we're leaving the European Union, expect the market to temporarily dip. I don't know why it would dip for that, but it would find some reason to dip. The other, the second.
Let me throw one thing in about that. This is the same point that was in the Scottish independence movement about this far ahead of the referendum, it was too close to call as well. I think as details come out about the bad situation that will happen to the finance in London. London is one of the finance capitals of the world, and that has a lot to do with the free trade agreements that they have with Europe, and those would have to be completely redone if they weren't part of the European Union.
So let's go back over to the other side. Now, some of you can remember watching Back to the Future, which, by the way, was supposed to the future was 2015 in Back to the Future. And you may remember when the Japanese were going to take over the world. And they were
in the 80s, yes.
Right, and they were buying golf courses in Madison
Rockefeller
Square Garden
Center
and all kinds of things they were buying. And everybody was expected to speak Japanese into the future. Let me tell you where Japan is today. The Japanese stock market, relative to the U.S. stock market, has fallen by a factor of 10. In other words, the Dow Jones Industrial Average and the Nikkei Average used to be the Nikkei Average was 10 times the Dow, almost perfectly, in the late 20th century. Today, they're comparable in price. Same numbers, which means that you can say one's risen and the other one's fallen, or one's fallen and the other and risen. It doesn't make any difference which way you put it. But the bottom line to it is that the Japanese have seen their stock, their corporate value, move to a position where it's one-tenth the relative value to the United States it was in the 1990s. Last but not least, the U.S. debt held by the public is about 70% of GDP right now. And it is holding there. It may slip back a little bit this year because our deficit has shrunk quite a huge amount. The Japanese debt held by the public, that's real debt. That's not Social Security and possible Social Security and possible future Medicare or anything else. That's real debt they got to pay back. In Japan, it's 250% of their gross domestic product.
Yeah.
Now, is that bad for Japan? Now, why does money flee to Japan anytime there's instability? Well, because if you have negative interest rates, which they do, in Japan, you're going to think this is crazy. People are paying the government to loan their money to the government in Japan. And initially that wouldn't be, you wouldn't think that was true, because if like you have a 10-year Japanese treasury security that was issued 10 years ago, well, obviously it has a small interest rate, very small right. interest rate. It's got right. an interest rate on. Here's what's happening. The Japanese government is buying back their own securities, which makes them drop in value, by the way, because there's more people trying to buy than sell.
Goes up.
It makes the interest rates drop. I mean, yeah. the value goes up, but the interest rate drops to a negative number, and then they refinance it at current negative rates.
Right.
And guess what? The traders have figured this out too. So they're out there running around buying up Japanese debt and flipping it back and selling it back to the government. They're buying it from the public, selling it back to the government at negative values, and making a profit on the round trip. Last but not least, in the very recent past, the Chinese were going to take over the world, and the United States dollar was going to be replaced by the Chinese yuan. And that's like in the last year you've heard that the Chinese yuan was going to take over the U.S. dollar, and they were going to dump all their dollars on the market, and everybody would be speaking Chinese, and we'd have to use their currency.
Right, and what if they sold all of our debt, and all of that stuff was wrapped.
That's all old stuff. Now, here's what's going on today, and Jake was the one who set me off on this, and I went out and looked it up. Billionaires in China are doing everything humanly possible to get their yuan converted to dollars, including setting up corporations in the United States to sue their corporations in China so that they can successfully sue themselves to get the money moved to Nevada, which converts it into dollars, which by treaty, China can't stop. So what's China doing to counter that, to keep the yuan from falling further? They're taking their dollar-denominated money and using it to buy their own currency with.
Right.
Which on the open market. In other words, they're taking their dollars that they have. They're not liquidating. They're using the dollars that they have, the huge reserve of dollars they have.
Sovereign wealth fund is what they're using.
To buy their own currency to keep it from falling against the dollar.
Right. I mean, think about the thought there. If you're sitting in the United States and you really wanted to get, this is how strange it is. Why would we want to get our money out of the United States? Once it's in here, it's a good place to be. Even Apple wants to get its money back into the United States. It would just cost a lot of money to do it. The Chinese are setting up these companies to sue them, and they're trying to get the company to look real enough that the Chinese government does not say it's fraud. If it is fraud, the Chinese have to prove it in a court in the United States. They have to come to the United States and say this corporation is not a real corporation in the United States, even though it's been set up as a corporation in the United States legally.
And so the big picture I'm trying to point out here, the United States, here in the United States, we're seriously considering how many times the Federal Reserve will raise interest rates this year, and the consensus, by the way, now is 2, which at 25 basis points each time, which means that at the end of the year, the Federal Reserve will have set interbank lending at 0.75% a year.
That's what we expect. There's no guarantee of that, but that's a pretty high probability.
That's kind of the consensus. And the reason is we're reaching full employment. We're reaching the point, typically, historically, when unemployment gets below 5%, inflation starts up because companies start bidding against each other for employees to do exactly the same work. Productivity falls off because they're paying people more to do the same job, and then inflation starts kicking in. So economically, the Federal Reserve starts raising rates at that point. Well, in this particular case, wages in the last jobs report dropped by a penny an hour. And the only thing that I've been able to find that makes any sense there, instead of wages going up, they're going down. Well, they're going down for good reason.
I've got a good reason for you.
And the good reason is there's a lot of new people, a lot of people who were discouraged during entering the workforce.
Right. If we look at the numbers of discouraged workers that entered the workforce and the new hires as a total, 555,000 people were either not employed or discouraged and became employed. So that's a fascinating number. That's a huge jump.
In what time period? Because we only hired net 242.
242 non-farm.
At the same time, we had a larger number than that leave the discouraged workers.
Oh, yeah.
They're not counted the same way because they're not looking at it as a, in a lot of cases, it's not being looked at as a new hire because they're being hired by the place that they were on the payroll before. They're either going from part-time to full-time, and that discouraged sometimes includes the part-time work.
Anyway, the point I want to make here, ladies and gentlemen, we are living in the wealthiest, most successful, most dynamic, most flexible nation in the world. There is absolutely zero danger of the Chinese overtaking us for being the largest economy anytime in the foreseeable future. They are busy trying to figure out how to deal with their problems right now. Europe is in or on the edge of or teetering on recession where they're having to do emergency measures to pull themselves out of the ditch. Japan is trying to figure out how to pull themselves out of the ditch. Great Britain is trying to figure out if they need to cut themselves off and drift off into the Atlantic Ocean.
I think ditch is the wrong word for the Japanese economy. I think this is like from one plateau to another. I think the Great Plains is where they are. It's the new normal. It's they are walking on a flat ditch. They've been in a recession since the 1980s.
Yeah, but they've actually slipped a little further into the negative zone.
Right.
And since 2009, they've been unable to come out of it. And here in the United States, we're concerned about the fact that we don't have enough people to do all the work that we want to do. We're concerned that we may get inflation, not deflation. We are seeing the United States having become energy independent. And we find good news, by the way, in the fact that Vladimir Putin agreed to not increase his oil production, and U.S. Oil rigs have gone from over 900, approaching 1,000 oil rigs drilling last year to only 293 this year, and we think that's really cool because we're producing less oil, and that'll make everybody happier. You know, we're in a country where we're having to deal with the problems associated with success.
Yeah.
While the rest of the world is trying to figure out how to avoid falling off a cliff.
Right. The very nature of our problem, the Russians and the Venezuelans and OPEC are all running around saying, what do we do? Our old technology is being replaced by new technology. We're dealing with, our new technology worked a little bit too well. Let's cut back a little bit until we can make more profit.
And another little thing that I realize is going to be politically very unpopular for me to say, but I'm good at that. The net immigration, illegal immigration from south of the border is negative. What does that mean?
There are illegal immigrants leaving faster than coming.
They're leaving faster than they're coming in. And there's lots of reasons for that, including an improved economic climate in Mexico, which was a government priority in the United States, so they can get their jobs there.
New ways.
Harder, a lot more crackdowns at the federal level on illegal employees in the United States.
One little tiny piece of that's going to get bigger and bigger is robotics. The idea that cheap labor is so hard to get, so the old quote, we got to get the illegals to do it because it's too expensive to get an American to do it. Well, robotics is going to step in again. It's already begun. You know, we see it on big lines, you know, industrial lines where the robots are doing all the work. Those lines are going to get repurposed so that they're even more efficient because the robotic technology is getting better. So that negative illegal immigrant rate is probably going to get more negative.
Yeah, and so the net here, if things are really awfully good here, particularly when we look at them in light of the rest of the world. And I realize that with all the presidential campaigning going on and everybody saying how bad things are, you may come to believe that. It just ain't so. Are there some things wrong? Yeah, I would really like to see a little better return in the stock market. I would like to really see interest rates get up a little bit so savings can earn a little bit of money. But again, if we compare our problems.
Yeah, with the rest of the world.
With the rest of the world's problems, we just don't have any.
China's having 50% drops in their exchanges, in their markets. So what we saw as a correction flirting downward, they saw 50%, which is as bad as we saw at the worst of the Great Recession, only they're seeing it regularly.
So, anyway, we're going to break for commercials. You are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach. This is KTEM, and you can give us a call on the other side of commercials at 947-1111. That's area code 254. And we'll be back after these important words from KTEM's sponsors. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and Jake McClure on News Radio 14 KTEM, or is it KTEM News Radio 14, whichever it is.
I think it's 1400. It's not even 14.
But it says right there, KTEM News Radio 14. It says it behind you. Oh, it says 1400 up there above it. Yeah. So lots of things in here. And they used to say right on the old 1890s console that was here.
Yeah, it had phone numbers on it. One of the phone numbers doesn't work,
yeah. China lowered its growth target to 6.5% to 7% range this year.
Mm-hmm.
Which is obviously, well, not obviously, but it's probably not the real number. But, and again, remember the things that we get scared. I think it's important to remember the things we get scared about and who told us to be scared about them. The problem is we keep believing the same people over and over again.
Right.
If you'll recall, as recently as last fall, China's economy was going to collapse.
That's what the news media was saying.
The market dropped 10 to 12% because of the fear of the imminent collapse of the Chinese economy. So the Chinese have officially said that their growth target for the next year is between 6.5% to 7%. And, of course, the news media comes out and says, well, they're going to have difficulty making it that high.
Right. And that's the well-balanced type media. They're selling bad news. The other media, the media that doesn't really understand economics at all, says Chinese forecasts slow down. And I wish that I could go through and put autocorrect in their computers when they're typing. So instead of saying slow down, they would say decelerate. Because slowdowns are recessions.
It's not really even it's deacceleration. Decelerate is slowdown.
Right. Well, you're just not speeding up as fast as you were. You're still speeding up.
It's deacceleration.
Deacceleration.
Which there is
decelerate.
In other words, decelerate is different. Decelerate literally means slowing down. Anyway, but the point is that the Chinese economy is growing. And according to them, a 6.5 or thereabout percent rate. Now, some people are saying, no, it's probably closer to 4 or 5. Okay, so it's 4 or 5. That is not a collapse of their economy. And you'll notice that the people who told you to be terrified of Chinese economic collapse never came out and said, oh, we were wrong. Sorry. No, what they did is they came out and said, the rest of the world is slowing down. The United States economy is going to collapse. When that didn't work, they came out and said, the price of oil is falling, so the United States economy is going to collapse. And now that we figured that none of that is true, the market is starting to climb back up again. I'm not sure what the next scare tactic will be. I suspect it will be, Great Britain is going to leave the European Union, so the world economy will collapse. And when it does, the United States economy will collapse too. Folks, only 12% of our gross domestic product is exports. We're running along at a 2-point-something% growth rate, and I expect it to get up to 3% this year. But let's say it's 2.5. That means if our exports drop by 80%, we would only grow at a 2% rate. As opposed to a 2.5% rate. Now, would a 2% growth rate in the growth in the GDP of the United States be uncomfortable? Yes. Would it be a disaster? No. We could literally lose 80% of our exports, which would be an incredibly unlikely thing since our two biggest partners are Canada and Mexico, neither one of which are China or Europe, in case you didn't know that. We are a nation that is almost completely self-reliant, except we need to do imports. Now, I want you to think about just a moment. Let's just say that the Chinese yuan fell dramatically, which is what we were supposedly afraid of last fall. Let's say the Chinese economy slows down, the value of their currency drops tremendously. What that means is all the stuff we buy from China, which if you go into almost any retail store in the United States that sells physically manufactured objects, you will find that they're mostly made in China. What would happen is all the stuff in those stores would get a lot cheaper, which means you'd be able to buy more of it for less money. Boo-hoo. Right now, and I've said this in newsletters, and I'll say it again, the thing we have to fear is fear itself.
The other side of this is that we buy a lot of stuff from China, and over the last 5 or 6 years, their charge that they give us for their labor has been going up. Our technology, the new technology that we're developing, is getting cheaper to make with that more expensive labor because we're finding better ways of doing it. But the labor costs have been going up in China. That's not good for the Chinese economy at all, because they're in essence getting the same pay or a higher pay for doing the same job. They're not getting better at what they do. That's inflation, and that's what they're hitting right now. We as American companies are beginning to shift out of China for manufacturing. That's going to cause the Chinese economy to drop. It's going to cause now they may grow enough in other places to make up for that, but as long as their labor costs go up, and that was the reason why their exports were so good to the rest of the world, if that's the only draw, then their exports are going to start falling. And that's a simple way of looking at it. Robotics is also going to eat into that. If the Chinese economy were to completely crater, as you were just saying, the impact on our economy would be very, very tiny. It may even be positive, because their labor prices would drop because they would want us to buy from them again.
Now, we can say it would be positive, but I'll bet if the Chinese economy looked like it was going to implode, the market would drop
like a rock.
Because people want to be afraid. But that's just not – it's not something to be – in the United States, we are a country that's almost completely self-reliant at this point. It's a very strange thing to be.
We do import more than we export.
Well, you know, it's funny.
But not as a huge percentage of our economy.
We import more than we export. We have a balance of trade, a negative balance of trade, which artificially holds down our gross domestic product. It's subtracted from the gross domestic product.
Right.
I don't really think we do.
We have a positive, but we don't know how to calculate the positive.
Yeah, and as a result, I think there's a tremendous potential there that we could be growing a lot faster than we're measuring at this point. Although that's good news, and we certainly wouldn't want to say that.
Right. No, the good news is for Biden.
So what we have is an economy that is, in my opinion, over the next couple of years, likely to grow significantly. And then sometime within the next around 2 years from now, which, again, will not be particularly good for the party out of power, whoever that is at that point, because that's congressional election time.
Right.
Will probably take off. Our economy is actually doing very, very well. And here's the reason I say that. The price of oil cannot fall forever. Matter of fact, it seems to have stabilized. And is the falling price of oil that people seem to be afraid of. If
right.
oil stabilizes as it is here between about $35 and $37 a barrel, which I think may happen, and is really strong evidence that it's not going to go back down.
Right. A lot of the companies in the United States are not pumping as fast as they could.
Futures contracts for oil storage, which had been a real bull market up
right.
until very recently,
right.
have just collapsed.
Because
right.
the stabilization of pumping.
Right.
We're pumping less.
Right. Because we're actually – we have to guess at how much is coming out of the ground.
Right.
Here.
We don't know. I mean, we could get a guess at OPEC countries because mm-hmm. they export almost 100% of what they pump out of the ground. We don't.
So the point is that what we had up until recently was the oil tanks getting more and more and more full. So the futures contracts on oil storage were rising. It was a real bull market. It was what's called a seller's market. And for some reason, So far this month, futures contracts in oil storage have fallen substantially, and they're still going down. What that means is there's fewer people thinking that 90 days from now I'm going to need more storage for my oil.
The reason is because they've slowed down production.
And
when you slow down production, you don't need as much storage. They were trying to make as much money when they could, when the prices were high, and that led to a huge glut in the market. But it also puts a roof, a cap, on how far prices can go up because those oil wells exist now. And if prices start going up, those companies individually are going to say, all right, let's increase the production. And within a very short period of time, they can get that to the market.
Well, I don't think oil prices are going to go up a lot, certainly. But
yeah, I think
also,
there's a cap.
I also think that the indication from that futures contract fall is that we're using up oil faster than we're putting it in the tanks right now.
Right.
Which
right.
I think may – we'll see that. And if that's true, then the price of oil may get up in the 40 range again here before too long. And if that happens, you're liable to see a bull market get started very fast because a lot of companies that people think are going to go bankrupt won't go bankrupt.
Right.
All right.
And we're out of time for this week. Thank you for listening, assuming that you have. If you just tuned in, well, thank you for just tuning in, too.
And if you'd like to contact us off the air during the weekend, of course, we have voicemail. But during the week, we have live people answering the phone at 947-1111. That's 254-947-1111.
You can reach that toll-free at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can email us directly, jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. You can go to our webpage, The Personal Wealth Coach. We've got .com. We've got podcasts there, newsletters, and a bit of our philosophy. Until next week, this has been The Personal Wealth Coach.
Your Fox News station in Central Texas. News Radio 1400 KTEM AM. Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood.